I'm Jeff Collier. I'm with the Youngstown State University Oral History Project. I'm talking today with Steve Crittenden, and we're talking about the project that I'm working on, that is the Vietnam Project. We're at the 315 East Laclede location, which is the United States Naval Reserve Center here in Youngstown, Ohio. The date today is June 11th, 1975, and the time is about 3:20 p.m. Steve, could you give me an update on yourself as far as up to today, what you're doing presently, where you went to high school at, where you're from, your marital status, and a little bit about your family, if you could, please?
Well, at present, right now, I'm working here in the capacity of a medical department representative, which entails processing all the medical records of the station keepers. There's 11 of us here, I believe, right now. They're regular Navy. And around 300 or 400 reserves, keeping and maintaining medical records and doing the medical administration, as well as handling all the military dependents in the area, naval military dependents, assisting with shots with their CHAMPUS, their naval, military type insurance claims, processing these and all. Prior to coming here, I put many years in the submarine service. Prior to coming here, I was stationed in Groton, Connecticut, at the submarine base, attached to USS Chileo. And I was there for 6 or 7 years, just after I went to Vietnam.
You graduated from high school in?
Graduated from high school in 1956, Baldwin Park High School, Baldwin Park, California. I'm married to Patricia, have 4 children, and ranging in ages from 17 years down to 4, and 3 daughters and 1 son. The 2 girls are very high honor students, or were at Canfield High School. The boy was Canfield Elementary, and the youngest, of course, didn't go to school. The wife, Pat, she's just a housewife.
Yes.
She went to data or key punch operator school here at Canfield Vocational School, high school. And she'll be working in that when she gets back to California.
Presently in the process of moving back to California?
We're in the process right now. Now, her and the children have left. They arrived in California earlier this week. I'll be leaving July 1st to go back to San Diego, back to submarines. And then I retire next year.
How long have you been in the service?
19 years and 1 month. And continuous duty. 14 of which has been at sea duty on board submarines, a year and a half in Vietnam, in and out, and 1 year flying helo missions over there, SAR missions, and then the last 6 months, which is a short tour, I was sent back to go to X-ray school and back to submarine duty.
As far as your tour of duty in Vietnam, what did you do when you were in Vietnam, if you could reiterate that, please?
Well, the first time I was over there, I was attached to the 5th Marine Division. And we did to the recon unit. We had probably 1 corpsman for every 50 to 60 Marines. We were short that time. In fact, they were taking a lot of people and drafting them into the hospital corps at that time. We were one of the big targets, corpsmen were, along with radiomen. And it was said when I was over there that if you could knock out the corpsmen and the radiomen, you had a complete little squadron that you're beckoning, And so there was even a word out that there was a price on our head at one time, if you could see the corpsman or the antenna of the radio. Needless to say, every time we went on patrol, we never wore a Red Cross. Everybody knew who we were. And we always gave ourselves a nickname, because so many of the Charlie, the VC, they could yell Doc, or they could yell corpsman or medic. And at this, a lot of guys would stick their heads up or make a run for that area and get put away or wounded. So we finally took it to a few of the guys. We'd been over there for quite a while, and we came to the conclusion it'd be a good idea to start nicknaming them on ourselves. So we did. We just gave ourselves any old nickname, Abe, Joe, Lou, whatever, for that patrol, because the patrols would range anywhere. 10 days, sometimes 2 And basically, it was just search and destroy type missions the first time I was there. And then I met up with an old friend of mine that went through FMS school with me, and he taught me into going to Hilo.
What is FMF?
Fleet Marine Force. That's the Navy Corpsman assigned to the Marines. The Marines, as you know, have no medic at all. So we go through an 8-week school, or it used to be 8 weeks, with the Marines, right at Camp Pendleton, where I went through. And it's a regular infiltrating type school, teaches you field medicine, how to crawl under enemy fire, and just field, go right through training with Marines. And then you're attached to a squadron or a division and sent out and wherever you need to go. Now, some of the guys, fortunately, got to stay right at Camp Pendleton, never even went over. Some went to Hawaii and stayed with those units, and then a few of us went right over to Vietnam. And I think, it seems to me that, not being picky, it seems to me that they were taking the more senior men and sending them over, which is good, because a lot of the more senior men would tend to be a little more cautious, I would think, than some of these younger fellows. Well, we even had a few that were a little senior that went over, and they wanted to be, like, I remember one kid named Digby, old Digby O'Dell. He would wear a 45, and he thought he was John Wayne or something, because he was really gung-ho. And he made it. He came back, got out of the Navy.
Did you carry a gun when you were over there?
I got to, because I was E5. Now, at the time I was over there, if you weren't an E5, you didn't carry a weapon. A few corpsmen did. Now, we used to, even the junior guys, we'd tell them, pick one up and stick it in your belt. Only for self-defense.
Sure.
And, but you weren't really supposed to. That's just like the Geneva Conventions card they would give us with a Red Cross on it was supposed to help us. Who's gonna sit in with us? So.
I've heard story about when they go in, and for instance, in the Hueys to pick up a group of men, fighting men, and the corpsmen were amongst them. The corpsmen, of course, they always said, drop your guns before you get in the helicopter, so when you get back to base. A couple people, I had to laugh, they said the helicopters would take off, there'd be half a dozen 45s or
this is true,
M16s or Russian weapons laying
this
there.
This is true, or there would be a lot of sergeants or corporals with two or three guns when they got back. But once I got attached to the choppers, of course, we got to carry a 45 all the time. And we only had a crew of five men. We had a communicator, the pilot, co-pilot, and the machine gunner, and then the corpsman. And so we did carry a gun because we were constantly, when we would sit down in the fields, we never knew when or if we were going to be invaded. But we always had the weapons. They didn't let us carry them.
What was the most hazardous job for you, the helicopters or actually out in the bush?
I think the helicopters were more because some of them, if you weren't lucky enough to get a lead-plated one on the bottom, they were very easily shot down. In fact, the one tour that I was over there, I can't remember the year, but we actually lost a helicopter shot down by a bow and arrow. A sniper in a tree was trying to hit the machine gunner because it was hovering. And he shot, but he missed, but he got the arrow hung up in the props. And down it went. Well, they got them all. But it was because of that bow and arrow. It's kind of tragic, but it was a fantastic shot, I guess. Really something. But and then one night, I remember my chief corpsman over there that was in charge, the squadron chief, was named Walt Deline. You may have read about this in the paper, who was the brother of Tab Hunter. And they always told us, we were sitting in Da Nang one night, there at the little air base in Da Nang, chopper base. And they told us, don't ever sleep in your choppers. Because at that time, if you remember, is when they would have these guerrillas that would come in at night and just make a run through, and that would be it, in and out.
Try to destroy the choppers.
And that was it. So they told us never get near those. Well, he crawled up in the chopper one night, and because it was hot, it was miserably hot. And we didn't know he was in there. Well, they lobbed a grenade in, and up it went, and he was killed. And he had six children, and he was ready again to come home. I found when I was over there, every time somebody was getting ready to come home, they get very, very
cautious.
not cautious enough. They get over zealous, I guess. You know, I'm short, I can't be hit, I can't be gunned, I'm too short. So they'd get very, very careless. And I lost several good friends at night. I lost a few guys after they'd leave the NOM. Plane crashes just didn't quite make it to Clark.
Yes.
And things of this nature. Lost a few buddies and know of several times, like napalming raids would come in our planes. They would hit our own men. But this was quite common, really, as far as, or common knowledge, not common, but common knowledge. Because of the brush over there, if you'd ever been over there and seen it, it's beautiful country. I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was absolutely beautiful. But treacherous for fighting. It's for ground fighting for us.
Yes.
Treacherous, because we're not the best ground fighter, jungle fighters in the world. And that's just what it was.
What would it be like when you'd go out on a mission when you were stationed with the Marines in the bush?
In the bush, well, we pulled normally three missions a month, is what it would be. We'd supposedly go out search and destroy for maybe a three-day run. Our job was do nothing but set up a perimeter around little villages or little huts there. And then, of course, the radio out, if there was definitely activity in there, radio out for them to come in with their napalm or with their little bombs, small stuff. And then go in and search and destroy anything, or take prisoners if able. And my capacity is strictly that, is for me, just to take care of the wounded and the sick, injured. And we did go to a lot of the little communities, little villages, and hold sick call on the citizens. And we weren't pressured into this, we weren't even asked to. If we got a good medical officer that was willing to go into the field with us on occasion, which they usually didn't want to, they didn't like to turn them loose. And where you can see why, because they
sure
they're pretty needed. And if we could get one to go with us, we used to go into certain villages and hold sick call in the local populace, take care of a lot of the little scratches and wounds and burns. We ran across a lot of diseases that, of course, we were very unfamiliar with, so we'd have to take them and read up on them, the doctors would. And they actually, certain doctors would come out and hold sick call once we determined that there was no VC around.
Was most of the fighting that you were involved with against VC, or was there any North Vietnamese Army?
No, most of ours was with the VC, mine. Now, as far as, this was when I was with the ground troops, and when I was flying, it was strictly taking casualties out. I wasn't involved with any one particular group. It was wherever we were needed. We used to pick them out of the ocean, out of the jungles. We tried to fly mostly at dusk because we were harder to be seen. Yeah, just where we could sit down, but come out before dark or just at dark. And nothing more than just rounding up both North Vietnamese, VC, our own people, and everything else, whoever was wounded, we would take.
Was there any preference? Did you try to pull, you would try to pull out Americans first?
We definitely tried to get Americans first. Like we used to take, I could carry 11 bodies or 11 remains on my chopper. And I would always, first thing I'd do when I got down, we were taught, go out the worst ones first, of course. And there was many times that I treated people, our men, right there and set them right back out. Minor flesh wounds, a clean wound all the way through, minor shrapnel wounds, minor burns and stuff. We treat those, send them right back in the field, and while our stretcher or litter bearers were loading the worst ones on the plane, and, or on the chopper. And then, if I didn't have room, even if there were real bad VC or North Vietnamese or whatever, I always took our men first. And you'd be surprised. You'd really be surprised the amount of men that refused to go. They'd look at a VC or a North Vietnamese, take him, get him out of here. I can go, I'm okay. You know, I won't get on that chopper, and they wouldn't.
Is that right?
I'll catch the next plane, or you'll be back, you know, tomorrow, or we'll be back off patrol in a few days.
How would you usually go in and pick them up? Would you usually go in groups, the choppers?
Yes, always. We went in groups only because of, I guess you'd say, riding shotgun, so to speak. We would go in, one or two would hover. The most I ever went in was with groups of three. One or two would hover, depending on the amount of casualties, of course. If they said they only had six or eight casualties, one chopper, two would go in, one would hover, one would sit down. And always just in the event that one got shot down, or plus the men down in the bushes. Again, it was so thick, the underbrush, that they could more or less, they could keep a watch out even at dusk. And but normally, we would go in with three. We'd find groups of three. One or two would sit down. And in these instances, when we had the personnel, we'd take three in. One would take the very seriously ill because they went on back right back to Da Nang. And in fact, some of them went running out to carriers that were sitting off the coast. And then the not so badly wounded, but the ones that couldn't return, would go ahead on the other chopper to the nearest battalion aid station, BAS as we call it, battalion aid station. And they'd be right back out within a few days. When we weren't flying and we were waiting to be called up, we did an awful lot of surgery and assisted the doctors with surgery. And in fact, I brought back, I wish I had them because I'd give them to you for your thing, but I left them with the museum there in Groton, Connecticut. I brought back so many slides, actual operating room. We had a pool, camera pool. We all had our camera with a name on it, and we had this film that would take 30 and 40 pictures at a time. And whoever wasn't busy would grab all the cameras and take two or three pictures of everything. We had the, right off the battlefield, amputations, abdominal injuries, a lot of eviscerations where the abdomen, all the intestines actually protrude out.
Yes.
Actual pictures of amputations and a lot of people hit by the bouncing Bettys, the landmines. And the VC had a real bad thing there. They work psychologically for a while on our men. The head man, or the scout, so to speak, the pointer, he very seldom ever really got wiped slick in the units I was with or got shot. He would go on through and trip a wire, trip a vine or whatever, which would in turn lob all kinds of grenades or bouncing Bettys or punji sticks or these very poisonous snakes they had. He'd lob them right into his unit right behind him, maybe 50 yards or so. And then psychologically, he would feel that it was his fault.
Yes.
These people were all mutilated, wounded, dead, so forth. So then he was completely out of the program, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they were famous for this. The punji stick thing, when it first started, we didn't have those boots that we had. And a lot of guys, we had a lot of amputations, awful lot, because they actually, they take human feces, of course, you know, and dry, put it right on these big bamboo punji sticks. And infection set in, there's nothing to do but amputate.
That was a pretty effective tool or deterrent?
Very effective. More so than the landmines, because the landmines, we had detectors. We could pick up most of those. And plus, most of the pointers, they got to where they could real well see them. You know, they recon men, they're really apt to. And so they weren't as effective as the punji sticks and the snipers. Snipers were good. Because again, it was so thick. I've seen us sit there for 6 and 8 hours, 40 and 50 men with one sniper holding us back because you can't move. And you don't want to move because you don't know where he is, but you know he's hitting all around you. And pretty soon, one of our sharpshooters, marksmen, would be out. But it would take hours sometimes, especially in the evening. Because he'd start sniping right at dark, and then he'd snipe into the dark, and he was afraid to move. Because he knew where you were, and you were just guessing, of course. And I've seen him sit there for up to 6 and 8 hours, in one sniper. Which isn't, that's not too effective.
No, it's not. You made mention of something that I hadn't heard before, and that is the use of snakes, poisonous snakes.
Yes, again, maybe the reason I heard of this is because, again, my capacity of a corpsman, we were the ones who were always called into these little caves that, in a lot of these programs, news programs and all, where they show them going in with flamethrowers and flushing these people out. Well, prior to us going in with the flamethrowers and all and burning these, the men we'd go up and stay outside of the cave entrance and put all kinds of bullets and shells in there, fire. And then one or two Marines would walk, you know, go in. And there'd be no firing. But they'd never come out. There's a little poisonous snake, average size about this long, sometimes a little longer, in Vietnam. Very, very deadly poison. I don't know the name of this, other than it's a deadly viper or something. They would take these, and I don't know how they did it. They'd tie by the tail to the top of the cave, just high enough, and they actually feel like a cobweb. The few Marines that lived were bitten by these. They thought it was just cobwebs, and when they go in and they push them to one side, these things would start biting them. And they'd fly and be dead before they hit the ground, so to speak, because by the time we get
to probably shock, too.
Very true.
Besides the poison.
And they were just, I really don't know what the name of them are, but they're a very deadly snake, and that was one of the... This didn't last long because as soon as we lost, I don't know how many men, but enough, then we started the fire extinguisher, or the flamethrowers, into the caves, all over, which would naturally kill anything. And that's when we really started getting a little, this was the first time I really had a sack. This was 61 or 60. And so we started the flamethrowers a bit, because so many men were getting killed by these snakes. And it was written up and sent around different. We didn't get a newspaper. We had the Stars and Stripes. But just by word of mouth, by communication, we didn't have plans of the day or anything. But as far as Vietnam, I think I have to say I'm very, very upset about it, because it seems like such a waste. We left millions of dollars worth of equipment and stuff over there. And,
in fact, I've seen that would be our biggest, as far as the number of dollars that were left behind when the North Vietnamese came down and took over Vietnam. They would be the country that has received more aid than anybody since they captured these weapons and things, which are worth billions of dollars.
Sure.
Unbelievable.
And they're all, we just walked away from a lot of them.
Why is it that they wouldn't take it to destroy them?
I really don't know, because I haven't been over there since 66, was the last time I was over there. And I really don't know their reasoning, other than they just wanted to get out in a hurry. It seems illogical to me to just walk away from this good operating equipment,
yes,
to at least not make it. They always told us when we were flying, if we were ever to go down in a helicopter at sea, we had flotation gear, of course, they always told us, the first thing you do is get the radio and communications gear out of there, even if it's, if that's the last thing you can do, get it out of there, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Don't leave anything. Well, see, this was early in the 60s, and I was so upset, in fact, my wife, she couldn't get over it, this last few months, I'm very, very bitter. Of course, when you lose a lot of friends over there, you see so many people that are wounded and mutilated.
Yes.
And just a waste, just one big waste.
What was the major difference that you saw between, you mentioned that you were over there in 1961,
61.
And again in 66?
65 and 66.
65 and 66. Mm-hmm. Between those two times, 5 years elapsed, and of course there was a great influx of men and manpower, of weaponry on our part. What was the biggest change that you noticed the second time that you went to Vietnam in 65 and 66?
Okay, now the first time, again, I was with the ground troops, and
yes,
the second time I was flying. So I did notice a difference there, but I also noticed there wasn't as much, to me, as much fighting, ferocious jungle type fighting, where men were just, as I said earlier, people would get very, very careless when they were getting short and all. When I was over there in 65, men weren't that way. They were more very cautious right up to the end.
Mm-hmm.
the officers, when they would tell us to fly and do this and that, they'd say, no, if there's any chance of this or that, don't do it. But beforehand, you know, to hell with the chances, I'm telling you, go do it.
Yes.
And this is the way it was. And we come into a village, they say, take that village. Don't worry about the cost. This was the first time. Now the second time, when I went over, if you're going to go into a village, go in and take what prisoners you can and be careful. It was quite a change in the... I don't know if some of this came about because of fragging, which went on over there. I don't know if it came on from right from Washington, so to speak, saying, take it easy on the guys. Or maybe something that was happening over here at the time that I was over there. I really don't know.
Could you?
There was a definite difference, a slowdown type, more
yes.
cautious type difference.
Can you explain what fragging is?
Well, fragging is when, unfortunately, it's when usually it happens to officers. It can happen to anyone. And it's when there are a group of men or a man, say, that doesn't care for his superior or for another man or something, well, they can actually frag them. In effect, they don't try to actually kill them. They just want to maim them. They'll take a grenade, a fragmentation grenade. You know, you were in the Marines, so there's different types. There's shrapnel, there's explosive, concussive, concussion type, and fragmentation. And this is just a name that they picked up over there, because they would put a fragmentation grenade, lob it near the officer, normally after dark or something, and just enough to really tear him up good. This happened, you could almost always tell, the officer could, if it was going to happen. The ones I talked to that were fragged, I talked to a few, and because there were quite a few incidences in there.
The ones that you talked to, the officers, were they?
They felt that it might happen. They said, I may have been too rough on the men, is what it would amount to. Well, several of them were written off as just wounded in action when they were in fact fragged, but never proven.
Yes.
They felt they were. They felt they were.
Was this common in 1961 also?
No, it wasn't. Again, in 1961, I wouldn't say they were more gung-ho, but they were more, let's get in there, let's do it, and get it over with and get out of here. This was the general attitude where I was stationed at.
Where were you stationed at in 61?
We're in Ben Hoi, Chulai. I was in Chulai. We jumped around a little bit in Ben Hoi and Dok To. And I think that's about all.
And in 65 and 66 you were?
Da Nang and Saigon, in and out of there, mainly because they were where we had battalion aid stations and
yes.
hospitals. And actually, that's about the only place we could sit down in a chopper at that time, other than in the jungles. And we didn't have 65, 66. We were more set up in there, whereas in 61, we were trying to go in and set up perimeters and set up actual areas to do this. They were made by then by the CBs and the Marines. And we take little villages and completely level them to nothing, make them heliports right in the middle of the jungles, which was nice. Of course, there were a few times that we would have a lot of firing around the perimeter. You never know who to trust. I remember one time we were sitting in the airport there, at the airstrip, and I can't remember where it was. But a lady come walking out of the bush with a baby in her hand. And you may have heard either this one or another one like it. And this was in 63, just before I left. Either in 61 to 63 the first time, and or 61 to 62, the end of 62. And this lady came out, and this is, again, was when people weren't, as they were still cautious. And this one Marine was going to shoot her, because this was, again, at the time when they were strapping things on children. Well, the chaplain came out, and I can't even remember his name, but he came out and said, no, we weren't to do that. It would not be done. He wasn't going to kill her. He was just going to fire to stop her from coming in the camp. So the chaplain went out, and he got blown up.
Got killed?
He got killed.
How did,
I wish
happened?
I could remember his name. he went out to take, and she handed the child to him.
And
there was an explosion. It was quite a ways down. Because we were all back. We were standing back. And actually, when Chaplin went out there, I turned around to go back in. Because I figured, he knows what he's doing. You know? And boom, there it went.
And blew it away. Huh?
It blew him and the child, and the lady was very seriously wounded. I treated her. She died. And we got her to got a doctor to look at her and all, but we couldn't bring her through. But it was...
But a person like that,
why
would they even treat her? Why would they just let her die?
I don't know if it's a matter of your own conscience or what. I treated everybody. It made no difference to me who they were, really. If it was a life, they told me before I went over there, look, you do what you can do to save them, even if you can save a prisoner. This is what they taught in FMS Corps, Fleet Marine Force, Field Medicine. So, I've seen other corpsmen just sitting there dying. I've seen a few doctors I won't say let them die, but not work as hard as they could to save them.
Right.
But my own feeling is, just like right here in Youngstown, I help out a lot of people I don't have to help. I've always been that way. I think if somebody can use it, help them. You know, someday they may thank you for it or something.
Yes. So it was all the individual attitude then. There was no order saying that you had to or didn't have to.
No.
Whatever you felt like doing.
That's right. With the exception of Americans, of course. We did take care of them.
Yes.
But as far as the VC or... Because now this young lady that came out, we don't know if she was... Somebody might have had a gun on her in the bushes.
That's right.
We never knew. And so we just treated whomever was wounded or sick or injured. Again, like I said earlier, we used to go right into the villages. There was quite a write-up in 65 or 66, I think, about a guy named Foxtrot Duck, a big second-class corpsman, a colored kid. Joe Lucier was his name because he went through x-ray school with me. And he was one of them that went out and made house calls in the villages. There was quite a write-up on that. And he was one of many. A lot of us used to do that. We enjoyed it. It would actually get our mind off the war. It was like going to hold sick calls and whatnot.
Do you think the people were appreciative?
Those that, I think, as a rule, they were. You'd be surprised, even the VC. Even the prisoners would, they'd be so grateful if we would work on their wounds. And you could hear them at night, you know, Doc, Doc. This is after they were a prisoner. This wouldn't be when they were trying. And you'd go over and they, of course, we couldn't understand them. And they'd mumble, and they'd smile, maybe, if they could. And then they'd go to sleep or whatever. But you knew that they appreciated it as a rule. Now, there were a few that would refuse treatment. There were a few that you would have to hold down, hold down to treat. Scared, not so much, because they didn't know what we were doing.
Sure.
And, of course, we were limited because we didn't know the allergies they had, what they might have. We'd treat them. We treated equally. As much as we could, after we treated our own.
Yes.
We always took care of our own first. And then supplies, again, also depended on what supplies we had. I have to say the whole time I was over there, I was well supplied, constantly. We always had medical supplies.
Two things stand out in my mind that I wanted to ask you about in Vietnam. One being the drug situation in 61. I'd like to hear your comments on 61 and 66, if there were any differences. And the other one, of course, is May Lai. I've heard some people say that that was a common occurrence. Some people say that was not. Your feelings on each of those things, if you would.
Drug-wise, in 61, I really can't say that I knew of hardly anyone that used drugs. Very, very minimal as far as people I actually knew that used drugs.
Yes. Now, when you say drugs, we could go all the way down to marijuana.
Everything. Okay. Marijuana, opium.
Okay.
And morphine was later on was good because a lot of the medics, corpsmen would get killed, but a lot of us carried morphine.
Yes.
And some of the Marines take it out of their pack, in the dead man's pack. And I would have to say, which you didn't mention, alcohol was more of a problem as far as I was concerned than drugs.
Mm-hmm.
We had some, because we were allotted I think it was two cans of beer per day or something such,
yes,
when we'd come back off patrol. And we used to get guys that would actually fill their water canteens with beer. And there's no place for a guy like that out on patrol. Mm-hmm. But I would say alcohol was bigger, at least in 61,
yes,
than drugs.
How about 66?
So when I went back in 66, I did notice an increase in drug users. But strange, most of it was just the marijuana and stuff that, as far as I'm concerned, I would never report a marijuana user or anything. It was like a tranquilizer, a very mild tranquilizer. They never got high, not one I ever saw use it. Never used it myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw a man that was going out on patrol get as high on marijuana, smoking just to relax,
yes,
as I did see a guy drink 6-8 cans of beer before going out and be hungover and not worth beans. So I saw more of it in 66, 65, and 66,
okay,
than I did in 61. But never really bothered me as a woman.
How about the
Mylai incident? Let me lie. I think that wasn't that prevalent that I know of. Okay. My own opinion was it was not a prevalent occurrence. We did go on search and destroy missions. We did go in. Again, as I said, in 61, it was go in, shoot everybody, not shoot everybody, but if you knew there was DC and all, take the village at
yes,
no cost. 65 and 66, it was be cautious, be careful, take prisoners if you can. It's quite a difference. And so I would say that's not a very common occurrence, or wasn't a very common occurrence. I wouldn't think so. Sure wouldn't think so. My opinion of that, if you want it, is I think that Sergeant Cowley, or Lieutenant Cowley, was a scapegoat. I think that that probably did happen more than that, not that often, but I think he was just a scapegoat. I really do. I'd have to say no, I don't think that was a very common occurrence.
I think that most people would probably concur with your opinion that he was, in fact, a scapegoat.
I think so. Because I won't say I saw officers or enlisted do that, but I did see a lot of people killed that could have been taken prisoner, but not as a massacre. They were trying to escape, or they were. But naturally, if a man's running and an American yells at him, he don't understand America. And I've seen people get shot. I saw a lady get shot one time as we was landing. We were sitting down in the chopper, and we were in a rice paddy, and I was loading on all my dead and wounded. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, come all this, it was a, sounded like a BAR, it was an automatic rifle. Well, my machine gunner opened up, but really at nothing other than the bushes moving. Well, this lady jumped up, and it was her who was shooting. Well, there were armed Marines out there, and there were Vietnamese interpreters out there, and they yelled at her and all, and they could have stopped her, I'm sure, and they just shot her right. Just one woman, I guess. You know, I'm sure that somehow or other they could have just wounded her or something. They killed her again. I would have checked her myself.
And of course, she might have had some explosive strapped to her. You never know from a distance.
Very true, very true. But upon wounding her, if she had had those, the usual thing over there for anybody, the Vietnamese, was to go ahead and detonate any bombs they had on them. Believe it or not, now I did see this several times. We would wound someone that might have been mined.
Yes.
In case we took a prisoner. And they go ahead, rather than be taken a prisoner, they go ahead and blow themselves up. So, and she didn't. And she wasn't mined. She was a relic.
Your reflections, if you would, on the people, the Vietnamese. What did you think of them?
The ones that I met, like in Saigon and Da Nang, very, very gentle people, I thought. I have to say, from a sailor standpoint, some of the most beautiful women in the world. They're beautiful women, I thought, like the Eurasians.
Yes.
And very pretty women. And very friendly. Willing to, I was always willing to be helped, but again, wherever I've been 20 years, a corpsman has always had good communications with everybody, even Japan. I've been all around the world, fortunately. And from Australia to Japan to the Mediterranean to up north to all the European countries, always the corpsman has been very easily communicated with the local people.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's just that medical insignia or what, but I always got along fine with them. never had any problem. Whenever we did pull Liberty, they were always willing to assist us with directions and to be to talk to us. And I found rougher people in Japan and Greece. The Greek men were very, very obnoxious, so to speak, towards Americans. They were very bitter, Navy men. But the Vietnamese, I found, overall, I'd say friendly. I don't think that they really expected too awful much of us. I think that once we got in there and got set up, the armies or the military became quite lazy, so to speak.
Our military or their military?
Their military. I found that we used to have to, when we'd ask one of them to do something or ask some of them to do something, they wouldn't do it. If there was an American around, they wouldn't load their own weapons. They'd shoot them until they were empty. And then they'd stand there and look at them and give it this until some of our Marines would go over and reload them for them when we were training them. They didn't. But now, since we pulled out, they did do that, so they knew how to do it. They were just using us at this point, the military. But the civilians were a different type of people. They welcomed us. We used to go into these villages and they would offer us food, their cattle, their homes. Very, very nice overall, I'd have to say. Of course, there was a few overall, I'd say. Very friendly.
Did you expect Vietnam to fall like it did?
No, caught me by surprise. Really, and it made me very bitter. There again, I would have to say that's the laziness. I really do. They had ammunition. They had the weapons. They had the training. And I don't know if you were told previously or not, but we trained them. We trained them hard. We gave them boats. We took them out on patrol boats and taught them to use them. We taught them how to use the weapons. Left them medical supplies, hospitals set up. Battalion aid stations, which are just a field hospital, left up, intact. And I think the fall was fast. It really, I could see it coming. I knew it was going. I knew it would eventually come, but this fast, it really surprised me. It caught me off guard. That's when my wife said, "Very bitter." She could tell. But you'd have to have been there, seeing your friends, lose your friends. Just a waste of time. A year away from here, for myself, or a year and a half, and plus the possibility again of getting yourself killed.
Yes.
And it seems all to no avail. It just seems like a waste.
Do you think we ever had the opportunity to win that war?
My opinion is not by fighting on the ground. It's one of the thickest rushes. Of course, it's not now, but when we started, had we gone in a completely clear dose, I think we'd have a better chance. But I don't think we'd ever win it on the ground in the jungles. I don't think so. I really don't, because those people were really something. Again, if you were there and saw it, you'd have to, they could be standing right there and you'd never see them. Never see them. And of course, they didn't believe there at the first of taking prisoners. They used to kill anybody who moved, even if you were wounded. That's what we used to try and get all of our wounded. They kill them. And I really don't remember when they started taking prisoners, I guess around the mid-60s. But before that, I had to go out here myself, and which might be a note of interest, to Lisbon, Ohio, and notify the Haefely residents Christmas Eve. The skipper and I had to go out and tell them there, Mrs. Haefely, that her son was shot down in Vietnam during the mission.
He was a helicopter?
No, he was a jet pilot, an officer. And then we had to tell his wife, who was living in Lisbon also.
MIA or killed?
He was MIA, and he was just declared killed in action here recently. But this was 2 years ago, and it was Christmas Eve. And that was pathetic, Christmas tree up and everything.
Oh, boy.
And I assumed he was ready to come home pretty soon from what she said. But he was flying off of a carrier. Of course, Washington sent up a full commander and captain, flew him up in a jet to go out with us to tell us. That was pretty, again, for a waste, for nothing. So, I don't think we gained anything. No.
hopefully we learned something.
Yeah, gained a little knowledge.
That's 56,000 people. I guess you should learn something.
I don't think we should have ever gone in on the ground to fight them. I think sea and air would have been sufficient. We've won all our other wars. But never have I seen any jungle like it. Even the Philippines, and I've been to the Philippines, they're not as bad as Vietnam. Was when we started.
A final question, and that is, do you think that South Vietnam fell because the North Vietnamese were so determined? Was that apparent when you were there, that the people, whether it be the VC or the North Vietnamese armies, were they that determined to win that war that they were so persistent that they eventually just won it? Is that the reason for the downfall of South Vietnam?